Entitled Opinions, not for the faint of heart, not for the socially mediated, not for the mimic men, not for the self-satisfied. Out here on the perimeter, we crush on the unknown. Out here, we look out and realize we don't really know much of anything beyond the sheer weirdness of whatever we thought we knew. Here, where the pillars of Hercules mark the threshold of the unpeopled world, the moon draws nearer to Earth than she was wont and makes men mad. The true and the lysergic are convertible. Knowledge forged by hallucinations. Comrade Giambattista Vico, quote, "Ignorance is the mother of wonder and made everything wondrous to men who were ignorant of everything." James Joyce, quote, "River run past Eve and Adams from swerve of shore to bend of bay brings us by a commodious vicus of recirculation back to Howth Castle and environs." Thus begins Finnegan's Wake in the very middle. We begin in the middle and spend the rest of our lives trying to catch up with where it all started. Stay tuned, friends. We're going to float down the incommodious vicus of recirculation wherever it leads. A show on James Joyce and Finnegan's Wake coming up. Stoned Immaculate. Today's show is a follow-up to the monologue on Giambattista Vico's new science that aired a couple of weeks ago on Entitled Opinions. I'm joined in KZSU by Corey Dansereau, a graduate student in Stanford's program of Modern Thought and Literature, who is finishing up an extravagant dissertation about James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake and its influence on psychedelic literature and thought. You can't write a dissertation about Finnegan's Wake and not know something about Vico's new science, which had a decisive influence on Joyce when he set out to write his super novel. Corey Dansereau is a longtime member of the Entitled Opinions Brigade, so let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediments. Corey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Robert. Thanks so much for bringing me in.
So you're no stranger to the new science. In fact, you were my teaching collaborator in the last two seminars that I've taught on Vico. The first time was back in 2019, and then once again this past academic year. So before we plunge into Joyce, could you tell our listeners what drew you to Vico in the first place?
Yes, what drew me to Vico was his legendary role in the composition of Finnegan's Wake. Joyceans know about this Vico connection, but few of them study the new science with a dedication proportionate to its presence in Finnegan's Wake. So I felt lucky, privileged really, to have the opportunity to do that with you, Robert, first in 2019 and again in 2020. What grabbed me right off the bat was Vico's weirdness, the first page of his autobiography where he attributes his genius to a childhood skull fracture. Last week, I fell headfirst from a window onto a bathroom floor in New York City, and I instantaneously thought of Vico, and I wondered if I would emerge with a philosophical golden bough like he did. Something similar happened to Jack Kerouac in the late 50s. He fell down and entered what he called the golden eternity, and maybe I'll mention that later. But yes, what drew me further into Vico when I started reading the new science was its psychedelic quality, its extravagant, shimmering, billowing prose, but also its content, which is nothing less than a psychedelic science of man. I mean, a hallucinogenic theory of the origins of humankind. At the time, I was involved in some research and teaching in the psychiatry and behavioral science department and reading authors like R. Gordon Wasson, Aldous Huxley, and Terence McKenna, each of whom advocated a version of the view that in the beginning was the drug. For instance, Huxley, man was a dopehead before he was a farmer, or McKenna's so-called stoned ape theory that a change in climatic conditions after the last ice age brought our distant ancestors into contact with psychoactive mushrooms, which broke them out of their monkey egos into proto-human social consciousness and behavior. So in 2019, I was amazed to find that these fringe theories of anthropology are actually variations on Vico's theory of hominization. What do I mean by that? I'll assume our audience has listened closely to your monologue on Vico, especially the part about the primitive religions. Those lightning bolts that shock the giants are not what they seem. If we read closely, we'll notice that they are not just a meteorological phenomenon, a perturbation of the sky that discloses the sky, but also a technique of perturbing the mind, opening an inner sky, an illicit science, he calls it, an illicit science of inducing those first thoughts of divinity and inspiring divine speech. Vico writes that the theological poets perturb themselves to excess with a view to the end of producing sublime poetry. Elsewhere, he says that they sang the marvels wrought by sorceresses. Note the wording there. The song itself was the marvel, the product of the sorcery. Vico continues in the same passage, this is to be explained by a hidden sense that the nations have of the omnipotence of God. The art or science of opening that occult sense, tuning subjects to the invisible electric body of Jove, Enlil, Jupiter, etc., is an highest institution of every nation. Every nation, then, is born of hallucination. And indeed, the Gentile deities are hallucinations. Vico insists that they are projections of juvenile egos who mistake their imagination for reality and disseminate their self-deception to others, forming a collective mental space, a nation. Malloy, a political scientist in our latest seminar, coined the phrase hallucinatory political theory. And in your monologue, you said that Vico had reason to worry about running afoul of the Inquisition. And indeed, he almost seems to be advocating a kind of atheism, saying that all gods are hallucinations, except that he maintains a distinction between the Gentiles' pseudo-divine hallucinations and the Judeo-Christian revelation. The course run by Gentile nations is, in every case, a long, strange trip away from a hallucinatory origin, a depressive fall out of a super-energetic poetic ecstasy or mania, passing through an intermediate phase in which heroic efforts are made to realize, conserve, and extend the manic visions, finally ending in the ambiguous completion and disenchantment of the human age. History is an end-static process, by which I mean a process wherein things move from a state of ecstatic inflation back into what they really are. For in the beginning, men mistook their egos for a supernatural cosmic order, but by the third age, imagination has dried up and sober reason prevailed, and it becomes clear that the gods were just human projections and everyone's really human. Metaphorical poetic language resolves into generic prosaic language. Now, the practical question for Vico is how to treat the depressive symptoms of all too human ages without opening the floodgates to delusional and destructive manias, what he calls the chaos of the metaphysical poets. I call this historical therapy. That is, the work of healing history itself, rejuvenating without re-bestializing. All of this is what captivated me about Vico, even put me in a frenzy, as Michelet put it. On the one hand, I felt that I had landed on a secret subterranean continent on which all my modern psychedelic thought and culture should rest, albeit later I discovered that the CIA were under the influence of Vico when they planned to turn America onto LSD. On the other hand, Vico's therapeutic project gave me a lens for understanding Finnegan's Wake, not least understanding Joyce's own complicated perspective on revivals of ancient religion and pharmacotheology already underway in his time. And we could certainly use some kind of lens on Finnegan's Wake. As it says somewhere, the further back we manage to wiggle, the more we need the loan of a lens to see what the hen saw. And by the way, the hen is always a pun on ta hen, the metaphysical one, the Greek word for the one.
Pardon the interruption, Corey. I just want to ask a question about Finnegan's Wake and psychedelics and your perception of what's going on in Finnegan's Wake. Does one have to be on psychedelics in order to understand Finnegan's Wake, a notoriously difficult, if not illegible, work?
Does one need to have taken psychedelics or even currently be on one in order to understand the Wake? Probably not. Marshall McLuhan reported that acid heads claimed Finnegan's Wake is just like LSD, but McLuhan himself had never tripped, yet he read the Wake religiously. Same with Joseph Campbell, whose Wake-inspired monomyth guided so many trips without himself ever having tripped. He got there just by reading, 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 as he put it. Timothy Leary, for his part, said Joyce's prose prepared him to take psychedelics, made him desire them even before he knew they existed, and gave him the idea of a cyclotron, a mental atom smasher. When he first started running drug experiments at Harvard, there was a sensationally popular lecture on Finnegan's Wake that same semester, and I think Leary's concept of psychedelic experience as the death of the mind harkens to the opening pages of Finnegan's Wake, where the hero embarks to Amenti, an amental place. Finnegan's Wake is about what goes on in the mind's absence, and the prose demonstrates this. This raw data moshing without stable concepts, an underworld where order is provided not by transcendental intellect, but by imminent feelings of terror and fascination. Maybe psychedelics can help attune us to this style, but really the only way to make headway at all is with a high degree of clear-headed focus, what you in your recent episode on Amor Mundi called lamplight love, and a good set of annotations. To reapproach your question in a different way, though, I think Finnegan's Wake can be elucidated by a psychedelic lens, a psychedelic Inviconian. I mean this very concretely. Several passages in the overture evoke the scenario of a shamanic initiation, a pharmaceutical vision quest, or what Peter Kingsley calls incubation. And this folds together with Vico's philosophical quest, as I described it earlier, a descent out of these civilized natures of ours back into the arcana of psychedelics psychohistory, the heroic and divine ages in search of a restorative power for a senile and depressed nation, a kind of controlled recurso whereby a resurrection or refleshment will hopefully occur. Very late in Finnegan's Wake, there are indications that we're coming down, back into the present concrete world, and a voice says, "We have enjoyed the secret workings of nature." Nature here must be heard in the Viconian sense of birth, the nascimento of a nation, leaving aside for now the question of what nation. If you look at the back of Finnegan's Wake or listen to most commentators on it, you'll hear that it is about sleep. I think that's too narrow. In the ballad, Finnegan's Wake, the young Tim Finnegan has fallen down while deeply intoxicated and is so unconscious that he seems to be dead. He isn't asleep. In letters, Joyce referred to Tim Finnegan as that shine toad, a German word for suspended animation or a trance-like state. Joyceans will declare things like, "Though little is agreed upon about the wake, it is universally agreed that it begins where Ulysses ends, with Leopold going to bed." Leopold Bloom, that is. But it's just as plausible, I think, to say that the wake begins at the climax of Ulysses, where Stephen Dedalus, whom the theosophist medic Buck Mulligan has dosed with an ancient Greek sacrament, collapses at the peak of a philosophical frenzy. His stream of consciousness drops out for 50 pages. I think the wake brings us into that concealed liminal state, a state of suspensive exanimation, a revelatory near-death experience. Joyce also sometimes cites Thomas De Quincey at key moments of Finnegan's Wake, and I think the book should be conceived less in terms of sleep and dreaming than of the kind of epiphanic flash De Quincey attributes to opium or near-death experiences, in which all-encompassing visions of life and the hidden structures of the cosmos are revealed. And again, for Joyce, this folds together with the Viconian therapeutic mission into the arcana of mental history, a controlled recurso to rejuvenate a terminal human age. As the rational humanist subject goes down, archaic, magical, theological archetypes swing up. The theological poet, the patriarch, the founder of nations, in Ivico, these are three aspects of a single figure, but Joyce diffracts them into three characters. A father, known by his initials, HCE, and his two sons, one of whom is a writer, Shem the penman, the other a civil servant, Sean the post. You could say that HCE represents the divine age, Sean the heroic age, Shem the human age. Shem, after all, is a universalist philosopher, a Bolshevik, maybe involved in a plot to tear down his father, HCE. Sean is a mediator between his father and his brother, a conformist who scorns Shem, but nevertheless wants to learn something from him. But we'll get into trouble if we try to hold these distinctions. That's true of the wake in general. Any attempt to separate things out into stable concepts will come to grief. I'm more confident that the father and each of the sons reflect an aspect of the first age, a divine archetype, trying to revive itself and restore spirit and meaning in an all too human age, with the danger of returning to gigantism. The patriarch HCE is introduced as a capitalist Freemason, Caligula, submerging his head in alcohol and hallucinating celestial architecture. Throughout the book, he's being investigated and or scapegoated as a powerful theopolitical conspirator and pedophile who flashed young girls in the park. The poet's son, the metaphysician, Shem the penman, the chapter about him is styled as an expose by a scandalized populist press. He takes mushrooms and flies like a reindeer by the light fantastic of his nose's glow, noses spelled with a G. He's infected with various diseases, including Europicolis, a disease related to the hallucinogenic fungus ergot. His infections are always also secret initiations. He's the sole contracted son of the secret cell, and he's writing a Viconian book that fuses all cycle-wheeling history in a single present tense. In another chapter, his story is told in the first person, and it's overlaid with Dr. Jackal's saga with transcendental medication. Finally, Sean, the older brother, is a civic figure, a doctor, a hygienist and eugenist, and a hierarch in a shady power structure. He's the Wake's equivalent of Buck Mulligan from Ulysses, but he also corresponds to Joyce's real-life childhood friend, Selsker Gunn, who had become the vice president of the Rockefeller Foundation. The opening pages of Finnegan's Wake depict the poet and the doctor, statesman, locked in a magical duel on a boat on a river to the underworld. And one aspect of the book's shamanic initiatory plot structure is that Gunn is being initiated into a medical, magical, or magical cult out of ancient Egypt. Tracking Gunn throughout the book gives a picture reminiscent of Tacitus's theme of the Arcana Imperii, the mysteries or secrets of empire, and anticipates the Joycean conspiracy fictions of Thomas Pynchon. Joyce's paranoid fascination with Rockefeller human science projects, narco-capitalist machinations, the Sandoz Pharmaceutical Company, which made LSD, global electronic media, and Gnostic apocalypticism, all of these come together in the fantastic image in Book 2, Chapter 1 of the global theater operated by Selsker Gunn, showing the radium wedding of night and morning, and peace perfect, pure, and perpetual. Now this invokes Kant, of course, but night means envy in German. This is another of the underappreciated themes of Finnegan's Wake, this proto-Girardian investigation of envy. Gunn is often depicted manipulating people and indeed taking over the world using the green worm of envy. The ethical plot of the book is that the giant poet, Shem, or Joyce, is watching and judging the giant statesman, Sean, or Gunn, as they both traverse the underworld, the poet's pen interlocked with the medic's syringe, the poet trying to master the medic such that he finally shapes up into a legitimate monarch rather than an occult anarcho-tyrant, which for Vico is the only non-catastrophic outcome of the human age.
Corey, you're starting to sound to me like Lucky in Beckett's Waiting for Godot?
Well, that's very interesting you should say that, Robert, because when Lucky gives that Finnegan's Wake-style speech, I think Beckett is giving a depiction of the relation between Joyce and Selsker Gunn, who I just mentioned. Lucky is a slave and a kind of court fool to Pozzo, an imperious power wielder who's playing God. He speaks at Pozzo's behest, and though he doesn't address anyone in particular, it's Pozzo who understands him. Indeed, Pozzo is violently affected by the speech and finally forces Lucky to stop. To me, it's clear that Lucky's speech mimics and satirizes Pozzo's claim to mastery of the world, and I think this is Beckett's microscopic representation of Finnegan's Wake, which he helped Joyce to write. Like Lucky, Joyce is speaking to no one in particular, speaking to anyone, speaking into the ether, but also speaking to the ruling intelligentsia who funded him and who will read him in the universities for the next 300 years. But also more immediately, he's addressing Gunn, the social medical commissar of the Rockefeller Foundation, whose quasi-metaphysical ambition to heal and control the world Joyce mocks in the Wake.
Corey, I'm going to interrupt you again and ask, because I mentioned at the beginning that your dissertation is not just about Finnegan's Wake, but it's about its reception among a number of American protagonists. And I would like, before we run out of time or energy here, for you to say something about that.
Yes, as far as Joyce's reception in America, very early on we have Eric Fogelin, who frequented Shakespeare & Co. in Paris and eagerly read Joyce's work in progress as it emerged. John Cage bought Finnegan's Wake in Seattle the year it was released, 1939. Then, of course, there's Joseph Campbell and Henry Robinson, whose skeleton key to Finnegan's Wake was a heroic effort of condensation and summary, heroic in its sheer speed, appearing only 5 years after the publication of The Wake. Over hasty, perhaps. And perhaps its significance lay more in announcing the arrival of Campbell himself. In any case, the skeleton key was crucial to the Wake's reception in America, especially when it was republished at the turn of the 60s, and I'll return to that. Marshall McLuhan, his early essays on Joyce, before McLuhan was famous, are quite amazing and strange. I recommend especially the essay Joyce, Aquinas, and the Poetic Process. He begins by quoting an early poem by Joyce in which he scoffs at other writers, souls who lack the strength that mine has, steeled in the school of old Aquinas. McLuhan thinks Joyce's epiphanic streams of consciousness are a rigorous application of Aquinas' theory of the stages of cognition. McLuhan likes to refer to this as a vivisection of the mind in action. In turn, he refers Aquinas' theory to the Eleusinian mysteries, but I'm not going to talk about that. Before moving on to the Joycean writers of the Beat movement and psychedelic counterculture, I want to mention that Campbell and McLuhan collaborated on a social science project at the turn of the 60s, an attempt to design a mythology that would inspire America and bring on a new age of global culture. The leader of the project was the Harvard social psychologist Henry Murray, who tapped Campbell and McLuhan for his 1959 edition of Daedalus magazine. Before discussing that issue of Daedalus, a little Viconian backstory is in order. Murray was America's leading psychologist. He wrote in an extraordinary literary style that drew comparisons to William James. He was also a leading Melville scholar, pivotal in the canonization of Melville. During the war, he was recruited by William Donovan to be the chief assessor and selector of intelligence agents for the Office of Strategic Services, the precursor to the CIA, which would continue to take cues from Murray in the future. Following the demonstration of atomic power in 1945, Murray...
Se non sono matti, non li vogliamo. I'm Robert Harrison for Entitled Opinions.